Is that working now, Paul?
It is.
Have you got enough battery? I know what you're like.
Resilience. A life in care.
If not, we've got a power supply in the car.
Well, that won't do us very good.
No, it won't do it, no. We have to do the whole thing in the car.
A personal podcast series by Tony Simpson.
Where we're coming through now is Shirley. Get in.
Episode 3.
So how are you feeling now coming back? Is there a sense of excitement?
Really well. Yeah, I quite like it. Yeah, Shirley. I know Shirley quite well. Very well. I mean, I'll always know Shirley really well. Welcome to the third episode of my podcast series in which, together with friend and radio producer Paul, I'm going back over my life in care. Although I'm now a business consultant, it's my experiences of care that have really shaped who I am and what I've become. Admitted admissions was that date.
Which was?
The 14th of the 10th, 1961. And then from the 29th of August, 1967, I went to Wildmoor Road in Shirley, Solihull, which is where I sort of grew up. And then, that's interesting, so on the 6th of the 1st, 1978, my case was closed. Even though I was born in a Salvation Army mother and baby unit, I entered into the care of Barnardo's when I was just 3 months old, and I didn't leave until after my 16th birthday. I'm one of the last generation of lifers, actually. I think from the day I went in October 1961, if somebody said, Tony won't leave here until July 1977, they'd have probably thought, really? That's a long term, isn't it, really? It is a long term. This podcast is part of Barnardo's Oral History Project, which is capturing and sharing the experiences of the Windrush generation and their descendants, and I am one of them. In the first podcast of this series, you can hear me return to the very building I was born in, and I also trace the journey my mother and her parents took from Jamaica to Birmingham. Their journey was about betterment, is about having a better quality of life, so all five of the children had better lives than the parents had. In one generation, they made a big jump. But yeah, I think if my grandmother was at the pearly gates, I guess he'd say she'd been a success. And I was probably just collateral damage to that success. And in the second episode, I go back to the first Barnardo's home that I lived in, Oakley House in Oxfordshire. Gosh. Do you know, I probably slept... That is so weird. You know, learned to walk here, talk, every skill of being a human being I got, as in neurological or physical, was learnt here. In this programme, we go back to the second Barnardo's home I lived in, and we meet some of the people who knew me then.
He literally ran around the house, didn't you? You remember? Jumping all over the furniture and everything, and then suddenly he kind of just sat there and he said, "Hello, my name's Tony."
And my father said to me when we came out, "My goodness, you've got your hands full. If you ever tame that one, you'll be doing a good job."
It looked like something out of There Is a Happy Land of Keith Waterhouse. And that actually was where I grew up. I grew up as the black kid in a Keith Waterhouse novel. That was my England.
Were you unhappy there?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, yeah, of course. I wouldn't have known I was unhappy, but I only know now as an adult, yeah. On the 29th of August, 1967, I left Oakley House, which had been my home for nearly 6 years, and I moved to Wildmoor Road, which was to be my home during most of my school years. If you listen to the last episode, you'll know that my memories of Oakley House, the stately home in the Oxfordshire countryside, was of a happy, almost idyllic space. The move to a small, double-fronted council house in the Shirley district of Solihull was sudden and traumatic. I think Oakley House saved me in many ways. I felt safe. When I look back at it, my first resonance of fear were when they called me in one time and said, you know, you'll be leaving next year. They sat down and told me, I remember it. I was 5 and a half. They said, you'll be leaving next year and you'll be going to Warwick Children's Home there with 3 or 4 of the other kids there. So for the next 6 months, I think I probably braved it out. Oh, my God. what the hell's Warwick? But then I knew I was going to the people, and between us, and I say between us, bearing in mind we're 5.5, 6 with no parents, it's just us, are trying to think, oh, it's going to be great, and whatever this Warwick thing is. And then I think about a month before, I was told I wasn't going. I was going to Birmingham, and everyone else was still going to Warwick. I remember thinking, what? And at that stage, I've never thought about this before, I probably felt massive betrayal. I'm sure I was terrified. I can feel it now as I think about it. And then it's like the lights go out. I can't remember anything from my first couple of years in Birmingham.
I'm just having a look at the photo of Wildmoor Road.
It looks so different to everyone else, isn't it? Just a castle house. Yeah, it's all these really nice stately homes. Yeah.
Jeez, yeah. Absolute 1960s buildings.
That's Kate Roach and Megan Parker from Making Connections, the arm of Barnardo's that works with adults who have been in their care and are looking for information about their past. It's here that I got my copy of the records that Barnardo's hold on me. And it's here that I want to get a better understanding of the thinking behind that move back in the summer of 1967.
From the very early years in Barnardo's, children, not by design, but they ended up living, many of them, in stately homes, basically, because actual buildings were bequeathed to Barnardo's. So many children grew up in these huge houses with extensive grounds and in large numbers, I should add. That was the situation up until the 1960s, really, when I would say the move was towards moving children back into a more realistic kind of environment in smaller family-sized homes, but also the location of those homes would be in a residential community, so that the house that they lived in wouldn't be that much different from the houses that all their schoolmates were living in.
So in some ways, was Tony's experience quite pioneering?
I suppose that's one way of looking at it. It makes it sound like Tony had a say in what happened to him, and I can imagine that for him, the difference must have been enormous. But yes, I would say that the time at which Tony moved into Wildmoor Road was quite early on in that period, where not just voluntary organisations like Barnardo's, but also local authorities were building smaller houses for children to live in as part of the local community.
Do you have anything that you want to add to that, Tony? I mean, how did it feel to you?
What I don't think people realise was it wasn't just the house, it was the shock of moving from the rural countryside in Oxfordshire to a council estate in Birmingham, where people spoke differently. I was the only black person on the whole of the estate, whereas in Oakley House, even though I was in a very affluent area, I was surrounded by kids who looked like me, even though at the time I didn't realise it, but I realised it when I moved to Wildmoor Road. And also, beforehand, we didn't see what families looked like and how people lived. And suddenly, while we're in this home, we're seeing families as next-door neighbours and realising that we're totally different. So in a weird way, it actually amplified the difference rather than hid it. It was a pretty sharp experiment because, there was no hiding who we were. You know, you couldn't shut the door and say those were the kids living in the big house on the hill. Because on the hill came down and lived within everyone else.
I think about what you were saying earlier about, you know, the varied experience that you had between Oakley House and then going to Wildmoor Road and how vastly different that felt as well. Your experience is unique in that you were very, very young when you went to Oakley House and you wouldn't have had memories prior to that. Obviously, children come from a huge array of different background experiences into Barnardo's care. You know, there are a million different reasons why children come into care. But some children would have had some experience of being in a family setting before coming into that more institutionalised type of care. And I think because that would have been your first memory, perhaps it was even more jarring when you went to Wildmoor Road because you hadn't had any experience of what it was like.
No. Actually, I think Megan's right. However, that trauma I experienced in making the move from Oakley House to Wildmoor Road can be traced in the Barnardo's paperwork that I have. I've been reluctant to go through them. Too many painful memories. So I've given them to Paul to go through.
These are all the documents from Barnardo's.
Yeah.
Looking through them all, they're sort of split up into the annual reports that they kept, which is just a record of your year within Barnardo's, all your school reports, all your medical reports, and then a few other ad hoc documents.
Yeah.
So this one is dated the 2nd of May.
I've never read them before.
Really?
No, really, yeah.
1967. 2nd of May, 1967. What struck me here is a description of you. Has a great sense of humour, uses imagination, likes company, plays in groups, easygoing temperament, shy when out of usual environment.
Yeah.
And, I think, significantly, seems worried about his future. Loves school, very intelligent, good at reading, probably above average, one of the best in his class.
I find that quite sad because the person described then is, I think, much more akin to who I am now. And it took me a long time to catch up to get that personality back.
Okay, what I want to read now is the next report, which is the 27th of March, 1968. This is when you're in Birmingham. Actually, why don't you read it? Just that sort of general paragraph.
Oh, yeah. Ooh. Has found it difficult to settle into the home and is not really part of the household. God. Misses all the boys at Oakley House. No one of his age group nearby that he can play with.
Keep going.
I don't want to, really.
You don't want to?
No, it's just sad. Gets along well with the children, but sometimes, yeah. I'm still reading it, but not talking about it, yeah.
Tell me what you're thinking then.
Gosh, it's funny how I feel pain on that already. Yeah. Don't know, really.
Do you mind if I read it?
Yeah, you can read it out if you want. Yeah, I just find it difficult, really.
Misses all the boys at Oakley House, no one of his age group nearby that he can play with. Gets along with all the children.
Yeah.
They accept him well. No one seems to bother about his colour. He seems to regret the fact that he was not sent to Mighton Gables, as he had expected, and does not feel that Solihull is his normal home. Sometimes is over-affectionate and demonstrative with Mrs. Booth, who I believe would be the
house mother. Yeah.
The house mother. Does not appear to worry about his colour.
Yeah.
I mean, there's two issues there. One is you've moved home.
Yeah. So what I think's tough about this is that's written down and that's exactly what I thought and nobody listened to it. And yet they clearly knew about it because I've written it down in this report. Here it is in black and white from an adult and yet nobody seemed to think it was a problem. And the sad thing is sometimes it's over-affectionate. It's like, really? No shit. The other thing is does not worry about his colour. He's once again, it's that theme that clearly whoever's writing this seems to think I should be. And it's more pronounced here because I think I was the only one who was not white. It's interesting. If I look at this school report here at the same time, it says, at present is apt to disrupt the class and will not sit down. Asks many questions. Is not interested in reading. Likes going to school to play with other children. And I guess, for me, school was an outlet. The sad thing is he's not interested in reading, so I hadn't seen school as a place of learning. I'd seen it as a place of having fun.
I mean, it's interesting because you compare that to the year before when you're at Oakley House. Loves school, very intelligent, good at reading, one of the best in his class.
Yeah, I know. Right, we're going here. Time now to finally go back. So we're now coming up to what was called the boundary. They used to call it the boundary, and it's the boundary between Birmingham and Solihull. And I lived up here. The home in Wardmore Road first opened in 1966, the year before I was sent there. And I haven't been up here. I've been up twice probably since I left. A smaller family-sized facility of the sort that Kate from Barnardo's had talked about earlier.
Looks nice on a sunny day.
Located in a residential community. In this case, a council estate.
Okay. Well, more road. What a strange place to have a children's home, don't you think? Compared to Oakley House. See that house with the windows open there? That's it, there.
Coming back after all these years, it was all the same, and yet also very different.
Blimey, it looks so smaller now. So I just think there's a big area, space between these two houses. Okay.
The home is no longer owned or run by Barnardo's, They closed it in 1991.
Bell out of order, it says.
Oh. Story of our episode, isn't it? Knocking on windows and doors, trying to get people to open them.
Well, I mean, while we're outside,
yeah,
just describe it.
It's basically a regular townhouse, really, council house. The wood's rotting a bit, isn't it, at the top? Quite small. Two front doors next to each other, two windows, and that's it. But there's nobody here.
Two stories?
Two stories high, yeah. I remember this, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about Wildmoor Road, then.
Actually, it was two council houses knocked into one. If you walked into the house, there were stairs either side. On each front door, so you had two front doors. An enlarged kitchen where both houses met. And then on the landing upstairs, when you went up either stairs, there was a whole open space at the top. And actually, we lived on the left-hand side. We've been the kids. I think there were only five, six children in that home. When I went in there, there was a family of four kids.
Who were brothers and sisters.
Brothers and sisters and me, yeah. So I'd
gone
in. So
completely different to Oakley House.
Yeah. I would literally gone from a world of knowing lots of people to just me and four others. So I think I just had to fit in. I knew them quite well. But I didn't think of them as my brothers and sisters. They were just people I live with.
So it wasn't the feeling that you were in a home with a family.
Oh, God.
This is not family home.
No, it was the five of us and the matron. But for them, I guess, they're all siblings. So I was living with four siblings, and I was just on my own. Actually, I really was on my own. God, I hadn't thought... Yeah, I was on my own. Yeah, I don't know what I did, actually, Paul, in all honesty. I don't know how I survived emotionally, but I did. But it was quite hard because it was quite functional. It was just a different world, really. And it's very small, you know, on top of each other, as opposed to Oakley House, which had lots of light and in the countryside. This was on the boundary of Birmingham and Solihull. And, you know, I went to school, came back to the house and slept, ate, went to school. That was it. I remember a period, actually, when I was there where once I was chewing gum. I don't know why. Oh, I do know why. For some strange reason, I'd been to see my dad for a weekend, and that's really odd. It's just come out to me now. And he'd give me chewing gum, and usually if you have sweets, you have to put them into a tin, and they were kept in the common room with the staff, and then they let you have it as and when. But I'd squirreled a piece of chewing gum into my pocket, and I was chewing it at night. But I must have gone to sleep with it in my mouth, and I woke up, it was all over the place. I remember thinking, oh, well, if I die doing this, that's fine. So at least I'm not so old that I've got too much to miss. I honestly remember thinking that. Thinking, well, it wouldn't be too painful because I'm not too old yet. It was just miserable. It was quite grey while I'm on road, yeah. I don't honestly usually think about that time. So I'm having to try and connect my brain to it now. This is... Oh, my God, it's so small. So these were the garages when we were kids. I wouldn't mind going... the alleyway at the back of the garages. My God, it's tiny. It's tiny.
And what did you do here then?
Played, run up and down. Just played around here, I guess. Hiya, sorry, do you want to go around?
No, just wondering what you
adopted. Oh, I used to live here. I used to live in the children's home, was there.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Is that what it was?
Yeah.
If we now move to the following year,
mm-hmm.
So we've had 2 years at Wildmoor Road. And here, it's the... Well, Anthony has changed considerably, according to the report from the parents, I think. I won't mention their names. On reflection, they found that on their arrival... So you had new...
Yeah, new house parents.
House parents. They found on their arrival at the home that he was very suspicious of people. He seemed to lack trust and confidence at the time. Now... he is a friendly boy and very popular in the neighbourhood. Anthony is extremely boastful, but if he were put to the test, he would lose confidence. He has a very good sense of humour. His relationship in the home is good. He is accepted by the other children. Is it the same children?
Yeah.
Anthony is a lively lad and could benefit from more scope than is provided here.
Yeah.
So this seems to be... a turnaround point. And this is you coming out? Or can you not remember it like that?
I don't think I remember it like that. I think this is probably me learning to cope with it. I mean, the fact that, you know, I was still having to build relationships with adults, you know, when I say it seems very suspicious, my rational grown-up side of me is really cross about that because I was probably just scared and wanted somebody. And also the lack of confidence comes from, yeah, because I don't think there's any reinforcement of my worth ever. So it was only to myself. And I think, you know, I probably use humour as a way of shielding, which, you know, I clearly do now. Even then they were talking about, oh, gosh, I wonder if there's another type of place we could put Tony where there are older children, without realising that, you know, that was my home. And every time I'd been somewhere for 2 or 3 years, there'll be, oh, should we put him somewhere else? So it makes you sort of just close down a bit, I think. And that's what I probably did. So my childhood in that age was punctuated by flits and starts, really.
A sort of lack of security.
Oh, a huge lack of security. There was no security.
No consistency.
Yeah. There's not only no physical consistency, but there was no emotional consistency. And sometimes you can just scrape by with one without the other, but I think having neither is really difficult.
I remember in my youth when I was low that there would be places that I felt secure. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, my situation is very different because I also had a family. Yeah. But did you have anything like that?
I didn't have a refuge where I'd put the covers over my head and think, this is safe. No, it's exhausting, actually. It was exhausting. My refuge was at school and friends, and I think I overcompensated with friends. I think I became, and I still do it to an extent, you know, I focused on the good things in everybody else's life, and I think I reflected them into mine. That's where it's quite deep, but I think I did. I use that to sustain me and emotionally to nourish me. Yeah, I did. Weird. For me, Wildmoor Road was just a building. It's not what I felt a home should be. A place that is secure and safe, that nourishes and cherishes you. All the things I now recognise come from being in a family. I hadn't been into somebody's home, as in a house, until I was probably 7.
You'd never been in a family home until you were 7 years old?
No, never. As in a front door, seeing somebody's, what a lounge looked like, or a kitchen, or anything like that. No. So the Houstons live up there. Rob, at the time, was a little blonde boy, shocking blonde hair. He just said, do you want to come in for tea? And I said, that'd be great. We didn't ask anyone. I just left the school and went home for tea. The story his mum says is we just both ended up on the drive. She was like, hello, Rob's going to put Tony in for tea. I said, Tony, where do you live? And I told her, and she obviously had to go and bring the home up, and they came to collect me. But interesting enough, you know, Rob and his family have been part of my life probably forever since that day, bizarrely enough. That's their house, it's got to be.
Shut down there.
Yeah. And Rob's outside with his dad. I'll park here. And this will be Joan. My auntie Joan.
It's nothing personal. I'm just going out.
Are you?
Yeah, we just said Dave's going to go to the doctor's. Look at his dressings on his legs.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, it's lovely to see you both. Are you both, apart from your legs, you well?
Well, yes.
It's lovely to see you. Oh, it's a shame.
You're old, Tony.
Oh, well, you know, we're all old.
We're older.
Well, you know.
You should get back if you're quick enough.
Yeah, I'd have to give you a cup of coffee.
Well, I said to Paul, you know, we'll probably have a nice cup of tea and biscuits with Jones in charge of stuff.
The biscuit tin is still the same, Tony, so you'll be all right.
I filled the biscuit tin yesterday.
I'll be back.
While waiting for his parents to come back from the doctors, Rob ushered us into that first family home I experienced.
Where do you want to go? Here.
You said the piano here, Paul.
I'll put him in the kitchen. Go on. In. Go on. Come on, you. Stop making a fuss. Come on.
I don't play 2 tunes on the piano here. It's the beginning of my musical career, actually. See this dog here? This is the first dog I ever knew. It's Blackie. When I was a kid, that was their dog.
Tony, you said that this was the first home, as in a domestic home, that you'd been in.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah, when you were 7.
I mean, you both remember that.
Yeah. I went to Burman School, which is literally just down 5 minutes away. Have you been yet, Tony, or not?
No. We literally just come, huh?
OK. I remember talking to my mum and came back here and I said, can I bring a friend home? It's the first friend I ever brought home. And she said, yes. No idea that Tony was from Barnardo's. No idea that Tony was black, because I didn't see black. I just saw this lad that I got on with that ran around as much as I did. So he came in, what, seven?
Mm.
He literally ran around the house, didn't you? You remember? You literally went mad around the house.
I honestly can't remember.
I can remember going, what's wrong with him? And he was jumping all over the stairs, all over the furniture and everything. And then suddenly he kind of just sat there and he said, hello, my name's Tony. It's my mum and dad. And since then, they've known you for what?
Mm.
50 years, probably more.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've known him since he was seven.
True. From the very start, Joan and David made me feel welcomed in their home. And they went on to play an ever-important role in my young life, a role encouraged by Barnardo's. In fact, the Houstons are often referred to in my annual reports, even if Barnardo's frequently spelt their surname wrong.
So it talks about Mr. and Mrs. Houston,
yeah,
as your social aunt and uncle.
Yeah. Most of the kids, there weren't many of us, there were five, six of us in this home, but we used to go to church every Sunday, and at the church, through school, which was a church school, we'd be nominated social aunts and uncles. And I guess because I knew Rob, his mum and dad were mine. And I think they quite liked me. So I'm sure some of the other kids would have gone to other people's houses for teas or lunches. So that's what social aunts and uncles were. So this was my infant school. I wonder if we're allowed in. Do you think they'd mind if we went in to say hello?
Well, should we try?
Yeah, let's try. Oh my gosh, so I genuinely have not been in this playground for 55 years. So this was Berman Road Infants. We're ringing the doorbell.
Hello. Call can't be taken at the moment.
Oh.
Sir, please leave your message after the tone.
Hello there. We're trying to see whether it's possible to visit the school. We're making a podcast.
Thank you for calling.
Hmm.
I think that's a no. Well, we're here anyway.
This view here with my back to it, I do remember. I remember the playground, strangely enough. So this building must be, wow, quite a few years old.
This is where you met Rob?
Yeah. That alleyway there, so you'd walk up there and along the side and you'd come out opposite his house.
I'd never brought anyone home before that, and for some reason, you know, when I knew this was happening, I kind of asked myself the same question. Why did I bring Tony home? He was the only black child within a radius of probably about 30 miles then. And to this day, I still don't know. But then as a child, I didn't see him any different than me. He was just Tony to me, somebody that would play. We could play together. We got on very well. And then I think as years went on, I think Tony would come here for tea every Tuesday or Thursday, and every other weekend he'd come. And so we just developed a very good bond.
Tuesday nights, I'd go to the house and have apple pie. It's funny, when I see them, I had my first nice food there. Most of the food that I sort of come to think of as English food, I had there rather than at home. So, you know, just apple and blackberry pie, I just thought it was unbelievable. I didn't have a cheese and onion sandwich until I was 16. I went to somebody's house and they got one. I was like, oh my gosh, food was just so bland where we lived, made by people in big trays, and you had school food. So going to somebody's house and having food, it was really nice. It was just totally different. So at the Houston's house, for me, it was food. I used to go and have really nice food. I used to think, oh, it's amazing. And they had a TV as well, colour TV, so I could watch Randall and Hopkirk on a Sunday.
I loved Randall and Hopkirk.
Do you remember it? Deceased. Yeah. Randall and Hopkirk, deceased. Do you remember it in a white suit?
Yeah. Those of you who don't know it, look it up.
It's amazing. I know. I loved it.
But we've also talked, myself and Tony, recently, about 7 or 8 months ago, about how when I was 14, 15, how difficult that was for me, because I felt Tony coming in and my mum and dad wanted Tony in that, and I found that quite difficult at the time, because in those days, no one gave you any kind of guidance around another child coming into the home. How are you going to manage your feelings? You know, how does that feel to me? Was he taken away from my mum and dad, which wasn't the case?
You felt jealous?
I actually felt a little bit threatened, because Tony, as you know, is a larger-than-life character. So he'd come in and almost absorb the whole room. And I was thinking, well, hang on a minute, I live here. And he's taken away my kind of, not status, but the way where I was.
Actually, they were really kind. It was different because I was aware as I got older, it was Rob's mum and dad as well. I didn't want to be seen as, you know, being, you know, a cuckoo sort of thing. And I, you know, I didn't want to be that person. So it's sad that I can remember thinking that at the time, but I did think that, yeah. So whilst it was nice, it was, I knew I was borrowing somebody's family. It's weird. My memories of the Houston's house are quite clear, and there are many of them. But my memories of Wildmoor Road are patchy and unreliable. So to try and reclaim more of those memories, I took Paul to North Yorkshire to meet with Jill Harrison, who in 1971 became the new house mother.
I went to look round the home because I was taking over. And before I took over, I said, well, I want to visit and see what I'm getting. I mean, didn't even know what the building looked like. And my mum and dad were with me because they'd taken me. The door opened and then this nosy little lad decided he was in on this. So he leapt over the banisters and ended up at my feet in the hall. 10 years old he was.
And that was Tony?
That was Tony. And my father said to me when we came out, my goodness, you've got your hands full. If you ever tame that one, you'll be doing a good job.
Did you tame him?
No, I didn't tame him. He didn't need taming. He needed encouraging and developing and all of those things.
How would you describe him?
He was very outgoing, quite outlandish, really. But that was Tony as people knew Tony. But underneath all of this, right from being that age, when I first went there, the thing Tony wanted most was to see his mum. He wanted to meet his mum, his birth mother.
Do you remember that?
No.
And initially, she wouldn't meet him. She said she couldn't. It was difficult because she was married and had got a family and all of that. So we suggested that they met in a park, that they simply walk past each other if she didn't want contact. That we just said, that's your mum. That was how the original plan was, because her husband didn't know about you at that time, so she daren't risk damaging her marriage and the family she'd now got. I think it was a big shock when Bernardo's actually asked her to do it, because I think that chapter of her life she'd put to one side. But in the end, she decided she would come, and she bought him a pullover, a grey pullover she bought him. And he was 10 years old, and he still wore it when he was 14. I took the sleeves out of it. We did all we could to extend it, because he was extending upwards. And he kept that jumper for all those years.
Did she come back into Tony's life then?
No, not really. It was a one-off. She was very honest. She said, I can't do this for the sake of my own marriage.
Gosh. I couldn't remember all of that, actually. But I sort of can feel it, but I can't remember it.
Yeah.
I don't know how I could have suppressed all of that. But suppress it I did. And you can see that in the entries in my annual reports. Constantly ask if there's a letter from his mother. Blimey. Yeah, you see, yeah, we talked about it.
Well, no. Explain that a bit more.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know why I'm asking. I don't know. Perhaps I was asking. That's weird.
You don't remember that?
No, I genuinely don't remember asking if there's a letter from my mother. Not only that, I can't remember the feeling of needing or missing a mother. Does that make sense? And that is quite sad. So I'm reading, yeah, somebody else's life in a weird way that is not connected to mine. It's not like I'm reading something that happened to me, you know, 15, 20, 30 years ago that made me sad. Constantly asking if there's a letter from his mother sounds sad, but I got no emotional tie to those words.
You wanted a mum. Everybody at school had a mum. And you didn't, and yet somewhere you did. So where was this mum? Who is this person?
How did that make you feel? Did you ever think, perhaps I should play that role? I'm asking you as an adult now. But how did that make you feel?
It's very, very difficult when you work in residential childcare, because the one thing you're told is you mustn't get emotionally involved. Now, how can you look after 10 kids for all that time? We lived as a family, and part of being part of that family is that they have a head or a mother figure. I was always called auntie in those days.
You still are Auntie Jill to me.
Yes, I did play the mother figure, not only to Tony, but to 9 others.
With Jill, I had the nearest thing to love without being physically or emotionally cherished. She was hugely influential in my life and provided me with a framework and a structure that has helped me to survive. But she was never my substitute mother and didn't really set out to be. She was, and still is, my auntie, and a tough and disciplined one at that. And my own mother, I didn't get to properly meet her until I was into my 40s. What's interesting talking to Jill is the different perspectives we have on life in Wildmoor Road. For her, it was a happy home, set in and part of the community. For me, it wasn't.
There was no problem with that at all.
Mm-hmm.
You were never seen as the Bernardo kids, ever. You were just part of the kids that played out on the estate. They all played together.
But we were seen as Bernardo's kids because the other kids would remind us all the time.
I mean, half of the parents, the local neighbours, worked for me anyway. They were part-time staff.
But that's the point, Jill. They all knew who we were because their mum and dad worked at the home. Yeah. And their parents would have talked about what it was like there. But I don't remember having friends round.
People did come round. Neil used to come quite regularly.
Yes, but his mum worked at the home.
I know, yeah. But he was friendly with you and with the boys.
Yes, yeah.
I think the best thing we had was when little Angie Lolly came and knocked on the door with a bag in her hand and she said, I'm coming to live with you because I don't like it at my house. And she lived next door but one with her mum and dad and her brothers and her sister. What I'm saying is kids never felt uncomfortable about coming into our house at all. It wasn't an odd environment to the local kids.
I think the children whose parents worked or were involved with the home would have seen it as going to the parents' workplace. I think my friends at school, they were nervous, which is odd. I'm not nervous, it's where I lived. I'm not saying you would be nervous, but they found it quite a strange place to be.
Yes, because it would be daunting. You know, it's not like just going into an ordinary house with 2 other kids and a mum and dad, is it? You don't naturally or regularly walk into a household with 10 kids.
While my memories of Wildmoor Road during my primary school years are patchy and unreliable, one thing I know for certain is that it was never what Bernardo's, Jill Harrison, the Houstons, and even my mother wanted it to be for me. A happy, secure place where I could feel safe, loved, and cherished. But I recognise now that it was a crucial time in my life. Those first 2 years there, after the serenity of Oakley House, was when I needed to recalibrate my life. I had to mature really quickly, and some of the kids I knew earlier on still were the parents' little boys. And so there was a stage when I'd go around and see them, and I was playing other people's little boys, but I was not a little, I was just different. I lost the innocence that I had when I first met them all, of being able to just be. I wasn't actually like them. I couldn't just be.
So what were you then?
I was on high alert from a very early age. I was trying to anticipate things that might go wrong very early on. And that's quite a tough way to live, but that's what I did. I was just anticipating potential problems, which didn't leave time to have fun or live in the here and now. Yeah. What joy. Should have come to my birthday parties. They were great fun. No, I'm really sorry. It sounds really miserable, but honestly, it was. However way I look at it, I can't, you know, dress it up and think it was a fun time. In many ways, it was a really dark time, but it was actually a building time for me in terms of my personality. I think it gave me my resilience, because if I hadn't survived those first 2 years at that age, my life could have gone in a completely different direction. And the reason why it was important is because I was on my own, and I had to dig really deep. And I've never actually in my life ever been that deep.
You know who you are.
Yeah, I think so. That's an interesting one. I had to. Yeah.
You have a sense of self. You have a sense of where you're coming from.
I think I do, because I had to, because I haven't had the luxury of not having that. I haven't been able to free will ever.
Can I ask a question then, Sam?
Rob Houston, who first took me into his home and who today works with children in care.
Where has that come from? Because, I mean, I deal with a lot of trauma, recovery, sexualized abuse, children. And one of the things they struggle with is their own self-worth and their own self-esteem. So can you remember a time where you suddenly went, I'm not going to allow this to get to me. I'm not going to allow this to dictate my life. And I'm actually going to show myself more than anybody else what I can achieve.
I don't know. I think I've always felt it. And the thing with that is it's not a Sunday afternoon thing you can think.
Oh, God, no.
It's a long-term way of thinking. If I believe that you were born with it, I think this whole series would be a waste of time because it'd just be a self-congratulatory thing. So I think you're shaped by it. It's not how did I do it. It's how did I respond in certain situations. And it's about patience, actually. If you can't see that your life might end up in stability, what they're after, actually, is security. If you can't see that, there's no point in having an end game. And I could always see that coming here or going to other people's houses, for me, my end game was actually just to be happy, not to be rich or not to own something.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that you can push forward. You don't have to be the best, but you are able to have them goals that are achievable.
Can I just add one thing, which is interesting? When you were talking about this sort of sense of self-identity, a sort of sense of who you are, personally, I didn't feel I had that sense of who I was until much, much later in my life. I was always scrabbling around, and my sense of identity would be through what my friends thought of me, what other people thought of me. But it strikes me that that's not how you operated.
No, because if I'd allowed everybody else to frame my sense of identity, I'd have had a problem because nobody thought I was worth anything. So I had to create my own.
And do you know when that sense of self emerged?
I can remember being about 10 in Wildmoor Road. And, you know, it was a pretty rough estate. I remember thinking I could probably run the estate within 5 years. But then thinking, you can't beat the system, so I'll probably end up in jail or whatever within... I can't beat it.
Yeah. Just to clarify, when you say you could run the estate, meaning you could rule the estate...
Yeah, I could be quite bad, because I'd probably outthink all the bad people and, you know, do anything I wanted to do. Yeah, definitely. Or you have to go the long way in a mountain in terms of do a thing as well as you can and then have a sustainable life where you're not going to end up on the wrong side of the law. And I can remember having that conversation myself, probably about 10 or 11. You've been listening to Resilience, A Life in Care. For more information about the Barnardo's Oral History Project, visit their website at www.barnardos.org.uk/oral history. In the next episode, it all moves up a gear. As I graduate to secondary school, people in the Boys Brigade actually were saying Tony's going to go to senior school, he can make sure people look out for him. I'm thinking, why would they want to do that? It was about survival, and it was about everything. You've got to think back to England in those days, Paul. This was, you know, pre-sort of British movement, National Front stuff coming in. I was bracing myself for it, yeah. I should put a thing on, shouldn't I? I think we should make a nod towards these masks, you know, because there's a global pandemic going on while we're recording this series. And I think if people listen to this in 100 years' time, they'll think they never mentioned it.
You think people will be listening to this series in 100 years' time?
I don't even think they'll be listening to it, Paul. I think it'll be a seminal part of the education system.